Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Mike Haggerty, sitting in for Randall White today. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to take a significant toll on communities of color across the country, and California is no exception. COVID-19 has amplified what were already deep-rooted racial health disparities in the Golden State, and the vaccine rollout is only further highlighting that racial inequity. According to new data from the State Department of Public Health, white Californians have received nearly 38% of the first available doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, compared with 16% for Latinos, 13% for Asians, and less than 3% for black people. Today, we're taking a closer look at the disproportionate toll COVID-19 has taken on communities of color. That includes areas such as Sacramento's Vietnamese-American neighborhood, known as Little Saigon. CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan recently wrote about how Little Saigon is grappling with new challenges during the pandemic. Sarah joins us now. Sarah, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
What made you want to do this story? What drew you to Little Saigon in the first place?
Sure. So I was excited to do a deeper reporting dive into this neighborhood because it's just so universally known as a hub for Asian Americans in Sacramento. But interestingly, it's also a relatively young neighborhood. Sacramento had a Chinatown at one point, which existed in downtown Sacramento and was destroyed by redevelopment in the 1960s. And very few remnants of that neighborhood still exist today. But Little Saigon, which kind of came up in the 1980s and 1990s, has emerged as this de facto place for Asian Americans in the city, which I just find really fascinating as an Asian American myself. Mm-hmm. And I've also just generally been really interested in diving deeper into Asian enclaves like this or Asian ethnic enclaves like this, because I think they also hit at this deeper question that I'm always trying to explore, which is, you know, what does it really mean to be Asian American? And I think the story of Sacramento's Little Saigon really opens up this conversation because it's a community that's going through this question as well, in a way, as you can see in this transition from an immigrant class to a second generation Americanized class who want to move up and move out, do better for their own kids going forward.
What does Little Saigon mean to the Vietnamese community here in Sacramento?
Well, Little Saigon, I think, is a place that's basically the embodiment of the Vietnamese American experience and journey to this country. If you've never been, it's the only place that you can, say, go to a Vietnamese doctor, then go to a Vietnamese jewelry store, buy your groceries from a Vietnamese-run grocery store, go to a Vietnamese pharmacy, et cetera, et cetera. The Boulevard strip malls are kind of self-contained, and if you don't speak English, you can pretty much most likely navigate your way entirely through that area speaking only Vietnamese. But as of course, I mentioned, it is also a neighborhood in transition, and it's changing a little bit.
Why is it important culturally?
So like I mentioned, I think it really gets into this question about Asian American identity and that portion of the story that I really wanted to hit at a little bit. Here's Andrew Leong. He's a professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston who studies Asian ethnic enclaves around the country.
You know, what's the impact, you know, of second, third generation becoming professional and start living, you know, quote unquote, white in the burbs? They lose that self-identity. They lose a piece of themselves. The question that is often asked of me is, why do we need to save these ethnic enclaves? Whether there's Little Saigon, whether there's J-Town, whether there's Koreatown. My answer is really, it's about belonging. White people have their space already created by the government. That's called suburbia.
Wow. What does that mean for future generations and the future of Little Saigon?
Well, yeah, you know, I want to go back to what Professor Leong said, which is that, you know, I think without this sort of ethnic enclave space like a Little Saigon in your city, as an Asian American, I think what he's getting at is that you may experience a sense of cultural loss or maybe a bit of a disconnect, especially if you're a second or third generation Asian American who doesn't necessarily have direct connection to another Asian country. You may not really know, there isn't necessarily going to be a place for you to call your own in a way. You know, I would say that I am not Vietnamese, I'm Asian, and I do feel more comfortable in the Little Saigon neighborhood, just walking its streets. The food is familiar. I know that I can go there to go shop for familiar food or food that I can't necessarily find in a a white supermarket, say. And so I think without these enclaves, like he said, there's a sense of loss that is experienced. And I think that this sense of loss is also something that I kind of want to delve into when it comes to members of the younger generation who grew up in this neighborhood and either want to move away or move out. A few of them mentioned to me that, you know, the Little Saigon neighborhood, it's still a neighborhood that's still coming into its own as a place to live. When Vietnamese Americans bought businesses and decided to live in that area, it was a very cheap area to rent in. And that's why they ended up there. And it still remains an area that's a little bit in transition today. A lot of the younger people mentioned to me that there aren't many resources for younger folks in the area and that the businesses along this corridor just aren't really geared towards serving a younger generation, either in terms of the services that they provide or even possible employment. Here's Jeffrey Fung. He's 28 and has lived with his family and grown up in this neighborhood for most of his life.
Well, most of the time, they want more freedom because South Sacramento is very, very small and it's not ideal. It's not an ideal environment for everybody. The type of community that we have in South Sacramento hasn't really changed since I was younger. There's a lack of diversity in terms of businesses around here. It's not built to retain people who want to progress and move forward with their lives and do bigger things. It isn't built for youth.
Now, Sarah, as you mentioned a few moments ago, Little Saigon is a fairly new development, as, you know, put in the context of the entire area. How have things in Little Saigon changed since it was first settled, and why have they changed?
So I think the community, interestingly, has become more of a business-focused area as a lot of its original community members or children have gotten older and moved away. You heard this, what Jeffrey Fung just said, there aren't many services for youth. He had specifically mentioned to me, you know, there isn't really a youth center for him to go meet other people his age who still live in the Little Saigon neighborhood. I thought that was a really interesting point. The boulevard is very much tourism focused in a lot of ways. It's got a lot of restaurants. It has a lot of businesses that would draw you to the area, but there aren't really a lot of community facing organizations that serve that region, unfortunately. And so I think that represents a shift. Linda Park, she's a former resident of the neighborhood and grew up there in the 80s and 90s when the community was really at its peak. She says growing up and going to school entirely with Vietnamese people was an experience she really treasures. But she's moved out to Elk Grove to raise her kids. And she says she doesn't really see that area as a home anymore in a way. And she said it does make her sad to think that her kids aren't going to have that same connection or specific feelings mm-hmm. to their heritage or to even this neighborhood, Little Saigon, that she had growing up.
And I would say that's one thing that I miss about growing up in South Sacramento. So at midnight, on the first night of Tet, like you hear firecrackers just everywhere, including like my house and, you know, and it was like one of my favorite memories and I loved it. And just to hear that, and it was just like the most festive feeling. And then, superstitions and stuff. So like we never swept it up until Tet was over, you know, like our whole walkway would be like covered in like those little popped red firecrackers. And it was like Christmas lights, right? It was something that was really special. And now, you know, we don't do that where we live because people would probably call the police.
That is just such a crystallization of how, what am I looking for? Ethnicity gets erased, Sarah. I mean, the idea that, you know, you don't have that traditional celebration because the neighbors down the street might mistake it for gunfire and call the cops. Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, it's worth noting that Elk Grove is, of course, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners know, one of the most diverse suburbs in the Sacramento area and maybe even in California in general. I think it's about 30% Asian, I want to say. And of course, I think this really hits really well at what Andrew Leong was saying earlier, how suburbs are a default white space in a way. And so even though you have a lot of these diverse populations or second generation people of color who have parents who are immigrants or, you know, you just have more people of color in these areas, it's still a default white space where there is some sense of having to feel like you have to conform to some idea of whiteness, which I think is really interesting.
We've got a couple minutes left. This idea of ethnic enclaves that change over time, it's not a new phenomenon. We've seen it in other enclaves, right? Chinatowns in San Francisco and L.A., even Little Italy in New York decades ago. Some might call that progress as young people make their own way, but the neighborhood remains an ethnic business center. What do you think about that concept?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because you look at a place like San Francisco, Chinatown, and in a lot of ways, it's a very outward tourism focused economy at this point. It's no longer an inward focused immigrant enclave. And I think that you kind of saw maybe the downside of that a little bit during this COVID-19 pandemic, where that area was really kneecapped because tourists are just not coming there anymore. And there just isn't a very large population. There is, I mean, there's strong population and a strong desire to preserve that population, but there isn't the same population in San Francisco, Chinatown as there might have been 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And I think that that is some sort of loss in a way also, to not have that community, to have built a community that's become so successful that they've kind of scattered in a way. And I feel like you're kind of trying to pick up the pieces a little bit as an Asian American. When you go there, you know, I think there's this really interesting question about, you know, Asian American identity is something that's so fluid, and even Asian Americans don't often have a great grasp on it, I think. You know, I read this great essay that, like, sometimes as an Asian American trying to define yourself, you go to these places and you see kind of like a fake image of what it means to be Asian American mirrored back to you in these enclaves that are supposed to be your home. And you're like, okay, I accept that. But like, you both know, the place knows you're lying. You know, you're lying. I think it's just this really fascinating question.
It sounds, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're in this state between a stereotype that isn't necessarily accurate and opting to act white.
Yeah. I think that a lot of Asian Americans are stuck in that space right now. And I think the COVID pandemic has really put pressure and really pushed back on that tenet that I think a lot of Asian Americans have been striving for. I think, you know, you see a lot of Americans striving for whiteness. They believe that if we work hard enough, we'll become accepted into American society. And then we see how that's a double-edged sword during COVID, where we had a lot of racist rhetoric thrown at us. We are perpetually foreigners in a way. And that is why these spaces are really important, to allow us to have a touchstone back, to feel accepted someplace and know that that acceptance is there.
Sarah Mises-Tan is CAP Radio's race and equity reporter. Sarah, we really appreciate your taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Of course. Thanks so much.
Up next, a closer look at the challenges facing the city of Stockton amid COVID-19 and how the community there has responded. Plus, we take a deep dive into how the pandemic and subsequent vaccine rollout have amplified what were already deep-rooted racial health disparities in California. Shoot us an email to insight at capradio or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Mike Haggerty, in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Mike Haggerty, and for Randall White. Today, we're taking a closer look at the disproportionate toll the pandemic has taken on communities of color. COVID-19 has amplified what were already deep-rooted racial health disparities around the country and across California. Many cities, neighborhoods, and other communities of color are still grappling with new challenges amid the pandemic and subsequent vaccine rollout, and that includes the city of Stockton. Joining us now to talk about how Stockton has been impacted by the pandemic and how the community there has responded is Executive Director of the Reinvent South Stockton Coalition, Daryl Rutherford. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mike. It's nice to be here again this morning.
Daryl, how has Stockton specifically been impacted by the pandemic since it started really about this time last year?
Yeah, the pandemic has hit the community pretty hard. A lot of loss of jobs, a lot of folks who have been displaced because of the housing crisis, and still feeling lots of challenges. And then, of course, you know, the challenges we're seeing with all the trauma that exists within the community. This has just brought a whole nother layer of challenges with dealing with traumatic issues within that community. And unfortunately, most of these issues have disproportionately affected the communities of color mostly out there.
I was going to ask, and I'm sure that this goes beyond one group that you can point to for an easy answer. So, you know, feel free to elaborate a bit. Who has been hurt or affected the most?
Well, really, I mean, you know, that very similar to all the trends we've seen throughout the country. It's the communities that are really been disadvantaged for a very long time. Resources have been extracted from these communities. You know, people have been taken advantage of and left to their own vices. Really, we're talking about the Black community and Hispanic community, and even, you know, the South Asian community. And really, those are the folks who make up the majority of the South Stockton community.
You mentioned the disadvantaged nature of Stockton. And that's certainly the case for many people. But Stockton is also a very diverse city. It's one of the most diverse in the country. What are you seeing in the city in terms of how that those residents, rather, have been impacted?
Yeah. No, appreciate that. That you know, I mean, we were identified as probably, I think, the number one diverse city last year. But that doesn't mean that diversity has really brought about equity. There are still a number of issues dealing with segregation within the community, redlining, and other things that have affected communities like this over the century. Really is, you know, one of the main issues that we're trying to deal with there. It's tremendous when you think about how resources and technical assistance been extracted from the South Stockton community and brought into other communities, really following the lines of new development. But what we're seeing are those trends kind of starting to reverse, right? We're starting to see with the new leadership that came in when Michael Tubbs became mayor, and in regards to our new city manager down there, Harry Black, a real focus on trying to uplift this community, because everybody's understanding if we can address equity, if we can get to the root causes of intergenerational poverty, we can raise and lift all boats within this city. But we really need to be deliberate and intentional and focused on the South Stockton community.
Daryl, would you say that the pandemic and its challenges has brought the different groups of people making up that very diverse city together, or divided them more?
I think it's really bringing folks together. One of the things that Mayor Tubbs' office did, along with the Reinvent South Stockton Coalition and our friends over at the Reinvent Stockton Foundation, done was create what we call Stockton Strong, right? And this was an opportunity for multiple partners and agencies to come together and really think about what we can do to you know, uplift folks who are starting to fall through the cracks during the pandemic. Really rallied around bringing food and other services to the folks who were in great need during the pandemic. We're seeing a lot more folks coming to the table willing to roll up shirt sleeves and figure out ways of developing more collaborative tools so we can have a broader and deeper impact on our communities down there.
Now, Mayor Tubbs is no longer mayor. He lost his bid for re-election. There was some controversy over misinformation spread by a new, I'll put it in air quotes, journalism outlet. Do you have confidence that the new administration at Stockton City Hall is still sensitive to the needs and committed to the progress in the same sense that Mayor Tubbs was?
You know, I think there's going to be a different approach. You know, Mayor Tubbs was born and raised in the South Stockton community. He came back to serve that community, and he really focused on it. And RSSC is actually a legacy of his work. He was a founder of our organization. But that doesn't mean we just give up hope because we lost our leader at the mayor in the mayor's office. Mayor Lincoln, we've had a number of conversations with to figure out our areas of alignment. He does seem to be very committed to the South Stockton community to the very extent, but again, of coming in with a different approach, a different mindset. And we just have to figure out how we're going to work together. You know, we are here to really uplift the voices of the people of South Stockton, you know, provide them a venue to where they can get the tools and other things that they need to be more civically engaged and raise awareness to their community. And we'll continue to do that and work with Mayor Lincoln and other elected officials to whatever extent is possible. But that doesn't mean we're also going to sit back idly and wait for action to happen. We're going to continue to push for action within the South Stockton community and make sure that all policies are really going to be focused on that, and that funding and other resources are directed into the community.
Let's drill a little deeper on that, Daryl. What kind of needs there have to be addressed to help minority residents, and what is not getting done?
Yeah, I mean, really addressing this trauma within the community is huge. Really making sure that we're not just taking a clinical approach to addressing folks who've experienced adverse, you know, childhood experiences or other things that have created trauma within their lives. You know, so let's give them the tools that they need to help stabilize their lives and kind of rebound from all of these issues. The other issue is around housing. Of course, you know, affordable housing is a huge issue throughout the state and something we've been addressing for a very long time. There's a huge need for new home ownership strategies within the South Stockton community, because we know that that's one way of building, you know, intergenerational wealth. But now outside of that, there are other things that we really need to be focused on, and that's making sure that people don't continue to fall through cracks. Coming out of the pandemic with this eviction moratorium, what's going to happen when that gets lifted? We're starting to already see that people are starting to get displaced, that some people are not following the federal guidelines that have been enacted. And so we really need to make sure that there are going to be tools in place to help people meet their daily needs so that they don't fall into homelessness as well. So a lot of focus on housing, and that's one of the things we're really taking on head on this year.
I know that the pandemic makes it a lot harder to have the grassroots conversations, the community meetings and things that you did in the past. How are you reaching out? How are you getting feedback from those residents, and what are they telling you?
Yeah, we've been very challenged, like moving forward on a lot of our civic engagement, but we haven't given up on that. A lot of our community partners are still on the ground. They're the boots on the ground doing the work. You know, we're the backbone of this collective impact movement. It's our partners on the ground who are doing the yeoman's work, and through them, we're still engaging with residents. The group Stand Affordable Housing, it's Stocktonians Taking Action to Neutralize Drugs. We've worked with them over the years, developing, building out what's called the trust builders, folks who are trusted individuals within the community who go to door and meet with residents. They're unable to get at that level like they had been pre-pandemic, but they still have a trusting relationship with folks to the point where they're answering phone calls. You know, they're willing to get on Zoom with people and let them know what's happening in the community. There is a big digital divide that we're having to address, and the school district has helped in a lot of ways. They really rallied the resources at the beginning of the pandemic under the previous superintendent, John Daisy, to make sure that their students had the tools they needed to be successful in this virtual environment. But that's also helped with the families, right? Being able to access mm-hmm. those resources as well. Is it by any means what, you know, are we hitting the need like we need to? Well, not like we want to, but that hasn't given, we haven't given up on that, and we're still figuring out ways to engage with people, post through this pandemic.
Let's talk about the vaccine rollout down there in Stockton, and specifically South Stockton. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so that's starting to take off. You know, we're starting to see the, you know, vaccines come out. We've actually been invited by public health from the county to help participate in the marketing and getting the word out around the vaccines and the importance of communities of color who've historically have, you know, been a little reticent to follow healthcare and get into that world. And so through us and our partners and our work, the trust that has been built with the folks over the years, we're hoping that that can help people understand that this is okay for us to get engaged in. My biggest concern through this is, you know, the access to vaccinations. Are people of color going to have the areas that are going to be, you know, accessible to vaccines? Are folks still going to have to travel completely over, you know, the other side of the city in order to get to the vaccines? So that's something that we're going to be working through, hopefully through this new program and, you know, the marketing and messaging and the tools that we're going to be releasing here over the next few months as the vaccines become more available to people, that we'll see our communities of color and those who've been hardest hit benefit from the vaccinations.
As you note, people of color do tend to have higher hesitancy rates when it comes to vaccines, and with cause. You know, one word, Tuskegee. What plans do you have for our SSC to help alleviate that? How do you plan to bring your credibility and your connection in the community to bear to get these people vaccinated?
Over the years, we've done this in a number of different ways. And, you know, we've built a lot of trusting relationships with the health systems. Dignity Health, Kaiser have been engaged in our work. Even Adventist Health, who's recently taken over Dameron Hospital downtown. They've been willing to get on the ground and work with the communities and work with our trust builders and even some of the community health workers that are out there. There are other ways of addressing healthcare besides just health care itself. You know, our work is around addressing the social determinants of health. And through that, through those activities, getting these other partners engaged in this work, in this community building work, builds trust with the residents. And they can see that, okay, now what Dignity's here providing food to our residents, you know, Dameron or Adventist is helping to clean up our parks and activate them and beautify them, you know. So there are a lot of different ways that you can build trust with these systems outside of just the healthcare that has historically neglected them. If we can address the root causes of the social determinants of health, then people won't be as reliant on healthcare itself to address this. But that's not necessarily, you know, going to, you know, get us to the addressing the pandemic because again, we're going to need the vaccinations to really get to the root of that.
It sounds like RSSC's role, at least initially, might be as a facilitator to build these relationships between these healthcare organizations and the people.
That's it exactly. We are a facilitator. We're a convener of community processes. We are the backbone, the hub of this collective impact movement. Building trust and promoting safety in our community is huge. It's been near and dear to RSSC from when it was a grassroots movement in the early days of its organizing. So that is going to be really key, is really building that trust and facilitating those conversations. You know, the police department has really, you know, wanted to step up and get engaged in a lot of this work. And that's a big role. You know, Chief Jones has done a great job at getting, you know, implicit bias trainings within the community or with his police officers so that they can understand why the community doesn't necessarily trust them to begin with. And you know, figure out how they can become better partners. And so, you know, that's another thing that's really great about our work is that it, you know, it's very broad, our coalition. We have the police department at the table. We have the city manager's office working with us. We have public health and behavioral health. You know, these systems who've historically neglected communities like this, but they're here rolling up their shirt sleeves with us, trying to figure out the strategies and interventions that are needed to stabilize the South Stockton community.
Daryl Rutherford is the executive director of the Reinvent South Stockton Coalition. Daryl, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you guys very much. Hope you have a wonderful day.
And you are listening to Insight on CAP Radio. It's 9:36.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
It's 9:38 from CAP Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Mike Haggerty for Randall White. COVID-19 has amplified what were already deep-rooted racial health disparities in California, and the vaccine rollout is only further highlighting that racial inequity. According to new data from the State Department of Public Health, white Californians have received nearly 38% of the first available doses of the COVID-19 vaccine. That compares to 16% for Latinos, 13% for Asians, and less than 3% for black people. Joining us now to help make sense of those numbers and the racial inequity that's been highlighted by the pandemic is Assistant Professor at UC Berkeley School of Social Welfare, Tina Sachs. She specializes in racial inequities and social determinants in health, as well as poverty and inequality. Tina, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
So give us a sense as to how the pandemic has disproportionately affected racial and ethnic minorities.
So much like your other exceptional guests have highlighted, the pandemic really lays bare what we already knew were problems before the pandemic. So those are the systematic inequalities and discrimination that people face in the U.S. labor market, in the housing market, racial and ethnic minorities are disproportionately represented among the poor. And so all of these things, inadequate housing, inadequate access to food, the fact that people, many racial and ethnic minorities are find themselves working in essential services, right? Are essential workers without the ability to social distance or to stay at home to work. And so all of these things have really exposed deep inequalities that existed before the pandemic.
There are other ways as well, and I think they bear repeating, that minorities are especially vulnerable to COVID-19. Housing, for example. Many, many of these people living with far more family members than you and I might.
Absolutely. And you know, housing is one of the biggest issues that that we face, certainly in California, but around the nation as a whole. And unlike other industrialized countries, the United States really has a very meager social safety net, and particularly when it comes to matters of housing. So we provide very, very little housing support or housing subsidies to people who are poor, or even certainly in California, the housing issues cut across class. And that's one of the major issues that we face as a state and the nation. And so we see that during COVID, people are unable to distance themselves if they're able to stay at home. And also another issue about the housing is that people, racial and ethnic minorities, also are living in areas in which they're affected by, oftentimes affected by environmental racism, right? So living in areas, their housing might be substandard, as well as the fact that they're living in areas where they're going to be more exposed to airborne particulate matter, thereby making them more vulnerable to a pulmonary disease like COVID.
How does distrust of the medical system play a role?
I think distrust is an important element of this that really needs to be placed back at the feet of the medical industry itself, the medical industrial complex itself, more so than somehow thinking that, you know, because many ethnic and racial minorities distrust healthcare systems, that perhaps that somehow puts the onus of the responsibility back on the people themselves. I think we've seen across the country that people have have presented to emergency rooms, particularly in the beginning of the pandemic, and may have been even turned away. We know that that happens a lot in low-income communities where people will go to the emergency room for treatment and then not be able to get the treatment that they need. And then there that might contribute to disproportionate mortality during the pandemic.
And let's talk about implicit bias.
Sure. So implicit bias is something that is very, I think, has gained a lot of currency. The idea has gained a lot of currency in recent years. I am not particularly inclined to believe that many of these biases are implicit. I actually think that the biases that people face, most of the biases that people face in the healthcare system are actually quite explicit. Hmm. I think that people face discrimination in a way that is quite explicit. I don't think it's really that implicit. So that's kind of how I think about that issue.
It crosses over into open disrespect then.
Yes, yes.
How has the sudden move to online health factored in? What concerns do you have about that also being a barrier for people on the wrong side of the digital divide?
Sure. I think that it's like most things, it can be a tool, it can be a double-edged sword. I think that it can increase access for some people. But I do think that for some people, it can be too intimidating. This kind of interface can be intimidating. And when you already don't feel particularly comfortable engaging with medical providers, it might present an additional barrier that can make things all the more complicated. But I think it sort of remains to be seen. For some people who perhaps don't have access to good transportation, accessing medical care through their phone or through some sort of telemedicine might be a positive. And so I think we just need to think carefully about the situations in which it's a positive, and also try to mitigate situations in which it is a barrier.
Obviously, the pandemic has heightened our awareness of many, many things, including the disparities in healthcare. What did they look like pre-pandemic? And do you expect that we might, in fact, lapse back into that rather than act on what we're seeing and learning as a society?
Sure. Well, I am trying to be optimistic that we will move forward from this and address these systematic barriers. And so what they are, what health disparities looked like before are what they look like now. We see that people don't have adequate access to healthcare providers. They don't have adequate access to healthy food, to safe housing, to good air quality. And also that racial discrimination in and of itself is bad for one's health. And so that has not gone away, and that is likely likely will continue to stay with us. I mean, we know that W.E.B. Du Bois was writing about this at the turn of the last century, mm-hmm. that health inequities were present for a very, very long time, and they likely will stay with us. I do hope that, like the writer Arundhati Roy has said, that the pandemic is a portal. It is an opportunity to think differently, to do differently, and to perhaps elevate an ethic of care, that we can care about each other in a way that is much deeper after we have seen the ways in which this virus has really decimated all of us, but certainly disproportionately affected low-income immigrant and communities of color.
Professor, let's go back to the data that I began our conversation with. New data from the California Department of Public Health showing that white Californians have received nearly 38% of the first available doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, 16% of Latinos, 13% of Asians, and less than 3% of Black people. What's going on there?
Well, I hate to keep singing the same tune, but we really see that the pandemic is not any different than anything else. The inequities that were there before are the inequities that persist in the present. And the structural barriers that people face to accessing healthcare and getting the vaccine are certainly there. And their racial disproportionality is obviously there. So we know that lack of health insurance can be a barrier to people accessing care. And we also know that information is a barrier to accessing care, and that these vaccines certainly are a hot commodity, right? Most people do want to take the vaccine, even though there is certainly vaccine hesitancy in many, many pockets of the United States. But because it is so important and people are wanting and craving this, it becomes something that that people are trying to use their influence to get. And we know that for Black people and other people of color, having those connections and getting access to, you know, important resources is tough on an average day, let alone with something as important as the vaccine.
Do you have a sense as to how physicians or other medical groups are reacting to these numbers in what's really already a very slow-moving vaccine rollout?
I have been heartened to hear so many people raise this issue. I think at the very beginning of the pandemic, I even wrote a piece for CNN in which I talked about the Tuskegee study is certainly always present. It is always there. But the real issue to me is access. It's not so much that people of color don't want the vaccine, although that is, I don't want to minimize that. That is certainly a real issue, but that access would be the bigger issue. And so I have seen many physicians talk about this and really try to elevate this much in the same way that you are, trying to get the word out that access is going to be the biggest issue and that we need to ensure equity there.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned your own optimism. What needs to change in the practice of medicine to mitigate racial bias? And how do you see the medical community working to overcome these disparities?
So one of the reasons I'm so heartened or I feel optimistic is because I do work with a group of medical students at the University of California, San Francisco, who are just so interested and committed to changing the way they are trained, changing the nature of medical education, to make it more not just inclusive, but to really understand that the very essence of medical training in the United States has been racially biased against people who are, you know, disabled, against people who are against women, against queer people. And they're really committed to understanding their history and changing their present. And so that's one of the reasons that I do feel hopeful about the future of medical practice in the United States.
Tina Sachs, an assistant professor at UC Berkeley School of Social Welfare, we really appreciate your taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Mike Haggerty, and for Randall White, and we are talking about the disproportionate toll the pandemic has taken on communities of color, which includes California's unhoused population. For the Golden State, major challenges continue to persist in homeless shelters and programs during COVID-19, which are suffering with overcrowding and the need for essential supplies. And vaccinating unhoused residents has added a whole new layer of difficulty to an already slow-moving rollout here in California. Joining us now is an organizer with the Sacramento Poor People's Campaign, Faye Wilson Kennedy. Welcome, Faye.
Thank you very much for having me.
How would you describe the state of shelters right now in Sacramento and the surrounding area?
Without being too negative, poor. Mm. We don't have enough. First of all, we don't have enough housing for the unhoused. We don't have enough housing for those who are low income. So it's very poor right now. And what's even scarier, come Thursday and Friday, the unhoused will be faced with rain and other weather elements that they're going to have to deal with and everything.
Yeah, and
start off the interview in a negative note.
It's about truth more than anything else, and weather, of course, as we know, caused deaths on our streets earlier this winter.
Yeah.
What issues apart from that has the pandemic exacerbated when it comes to the unhoused population here?
Sure, I just think probably just a lack of access to resources in general. Prior to the pandemic, so for example, the unhoused community on Stockton Boulevard in most communities could go to their library to access the internet, to use the bathroom, to get fresh water. Once the pandemic hit and everything was shut down, they lost their access to those resources. They lost their access to resources like they could find at community centers, a lot of church had their doors open. But once the pandemic hit, and people became fearful because they didn't know the right procedures for sanitation and hygiene. The unhoused community throughout California, and particularly in Sacramento, was just kind of like left to fend for themselves. So the outgrowth of that, we formed an organization, which the Poor People's Campaign is a part of. It's called Services Not Suites. It's about 20-some organizations, as well as individuals, trying to connect the unhoused to services to improve their quality of life. Things that we take for granted, those of us who have the pleasure and honor and privilege to live in a house, an apartment, a trailer, the unhoused don't have access to running water, electricity, bathroom, showers, a place to charge your phone, really basic things like that.
Are those the biggest needs that need to be addressed, or are there others?
The biggest need is to get people in housing, to get them off the street into some type of housing, whether it's sheltered housing, whether it's living in a motel. But the end goal is to get people into some permanent housing, apartments, duplexes, mobile homes. That's what we have to do as a community, as a state, as a nation community, to find ways to get people off the streets, out of encampments, out of cars, living on the street, into some type of permanent housing.
How helpful has the governor's Project Home Key and Project Room Key been?
I think it's been helpful, but for a small number of people. I think probably less than 1,000 people locally have been through that particular program. And you have to remember, on any given night, we have about 5,000 people who are unhoused on the streets of Sacramento. So right now, if you, no matter where you live, if you live in the Green Haven area near the river, you see that. If you live on Stockton Boulevard, have to go up and down Stockton Boulevard, a Power Inn Road, a Fruit Ridge Road, you see folks who are unhoused. Many of them once had jobs and were working, and the pandemic hit, and they were able, their hours were reduced, or the businesses closed down, and they became unhoused. So here we are, and we're trying to address the problem, but I think because many of us, we have houses, and we just don't understand that what a privilege it is for us to live in a house, and what such dire straits those who are unhoused are faced on a daily basis.
Faye, where do unhoused residents stand in terms of their place in the COVID-19 vaccine line? What does that priority look like?
Well, that's a good question. So those who are currently enrolled in shelter programs, like the Meadowview Women's Shelter, different places like that, they will probably have access to the vaccine because the workers will have access to the vaccine. But if those folks who are currently living in encampments throughout Sacramento, right now, they're not a priority, as well as those who are volunteers. So, for example, the Poor People's Campaign, we have anywhere between low 5 up to 10 volunteers on any given day out volunteering, myself included. We are not a priority because we're not paid employees. We are volunteers delivering basic needs to the unhoused in encampment. So right now, the unhoused in encampments are not a priority, nor are the volunteers who are providing the basic needs are a priority to get the vaccine. So we're posing those questions to the powers to be within the county. What about the unhoused? What about the volunteers who are providing those basic needs? I just got my first shot last Saturday after 2.5 weeks of scouring through emails, through websites, and I finally got vaccinated, my husband and I. But right now, I'm not a priority because I'm a volunteer with the unhoused providing basic needs.
I would think that would make you a priority.
You would think so, but right now it's not. But we're making our voices. We're emailing. We're trying to talk to the appropriate individuals and entities.
And what kind of conversations are you having with city, state, and other advocacy groups?
Well, sure. Saying that the unhoused need to be a priority, that the vaccine clinics probably need to happen in encampments, because once again, you and I may have access to transportation. They don't. So they can't do a drive-through. They can't do a walk-through. The vaccine clinics have to come where they are, similar to the way when you do the flu clinics. You have to come to where they are and everything.
Right.
Or provide some type of support services to get them to the vaccination clinics and everything.
Faye Wilson Kennedy, organizer with the Sacramento Poor People's Campaign, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you very much.
And we have a bit of breaking news. Rush Limbaugh, conservative media icon, talk show host, has died at the age of 70 this morning. He was suffering from cancer. He began his talk career at KFBK AM here in Sacramento in 1984 and then developed his program into a nationally syndicated program. Once again, Rush Limbaugh, dead of cancer at the age of 70. That's Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Our technical director is Mark Jones, engineer Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Mike Haggerty, in for Randall White. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow when Nicole Nixon will be your host. I'll have news for you this afternoon on All Things Considered.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.